Thank you, Mr. Haney. I don't know about you, brethren, but I like to learn the easy way. Have you ever prayed that in your prayers? God, help me to learn the easy way. Because we inevitably, it seems, learn, but it's awfully difficult or challenging to learn the hard way. The Bible is unique in one respect, that it writes about heroes and heroines, but it doesn't sugarcoat them. It writes about their reality, their good, their bad, their good decisions, their bad decisions, their positive character traits, and their flaws. And it's unique in that respect to show the flaws of the individuals that God worked with. God has recorded the life story of many individuals, not for entertainment, but for what purpose? So that we might learn lessons from their lives to apply in ours. And if we're diligent about this, is it possible that we will learn the easy way by reading about the mistakes or the flaws of others so that we might not repeat those things, to learn from the strengths of those God has recorded in the Bible so that we can imitate those? Well, today during the course of the sermon, we're going to take a look at one individual in the Scripture, one of the 12 sons of Jacob, whose life we will examine to gather what we might be able to apply in our lives today. That character is the man Judah. Judah was the fourth son of Israel and his wife Leah. If you turn with me back to the book of Genesis, to begin with, we'll get just a bit of background about Judah so that we can place him in context. I mean, the word Judah is used a lot in the Scripture, a lot in the church. We think of the children of Judah, the kings of Judah. We think of the future of Judah. And sometimes we may forget the background to this individual and where he came from, what he learned, and how he grew. And we might find some things that are rather familiar, some in a good way and some maybe in not such a good way. Genesis chapter 29 is where Judah is introduced to us. Now, by way of background, Judah came into the world in what we might call a bit of an odd situation. Wouldn't you say that was the case? Here's this young man, Jacob. Jacob had been a crooked kind of individual. He stole from his brother the birthright. And then, because he had stole the blessing, his brother basically wanted to kill him. So mama said, get out of here, go live with my brother, your uncle Laban, and live there. Well, while Jacob is there, of course, he falls in love with Laban's daughter, Rachel. And apparently she is just a beautiful person, and he loved her. So Laban kind of noticed this and basically said, if you don't mind working for the next 7 years, I'll give you Rachel as your wife. Now, some would say no woman is worth 7 years. Others of us would say the woman we have is worth 40 years of our lives or our entire lives. Certainly, it may be that Jacob felt that way about Rachel. In Genesis chapter 29 and verse 18, it said, Jacob loved Rachel. So he said, I'll serve you 7 years for Rachel, your younger daughter. And Laban said, fine. Get busy. I paraphrase that. So he began working. Verse 20, Jacob served 7 years for Rachel, and they seemed only a few days to him because of the love he had for her. Then Jacob said to Laban, give me my wife. I mean, he had the calendar out. He's crossing off days. He gets down to the 7 years. It's finished. Now is the time to give me Rachel. And you remember what happened. Yes, okay, we'll do that. Give me my wife for my days to fulfill that I might go into her, verse 22. In other words, consummate the marriage, start to live together, etc. Laban gathered together all the men of the place and made a feast. Here's the big wedding feast. It came to pass in the evening that he took Leah, his daughter, and brought her to Jacob, and he went into her. Well, wait a second. So the switch was made. Now, as a parenthetical statement in verse 24, Laban gave his maid Zilpah to his daughter Leah as a maid, kind of a maidservant, a right-hand woman, we might say, help run the household, etc. So verse 25, shock of shocks, it came to pass in the morning that, behold, it was Leah. Now, we're not told how Jacob could have made that mistake. Was he drunk after the feast? We don't know. Was it simply dark in there? And you don't talk, you just get busy and then you go to bed. I don't know what happened here. Well, the Bible is just very open about these things. We don't need to be ashamed of these things. This is what God has recorded for us. So whatever it was, Jacob didn't know until the morning and the lights are on, the sun comes up, and it's not Rachel, it's Leah that is there. It came to pass in the morning, behold, it was Leah. And he said to Laban, "What is this that you have done to me? Was it not for Rachel I served you? Why then have you deceived me?" And Laban said, "It must not be done so in our country to give the younger before the firstborn." Now, maybe that was true. Maybe that was a tradition there. Some scholars seem to think it was, not just an open lie. But for 7 years, you didn't tell your future son-in-law that this was the rule around here? Well, there was obvious deception involved. So, verse 27, "Fulfill her week, and we will give you this one also for the service which you will serve with me still another 7 years." So look, I'll give you Rachel if you promise, you pledge to work another 7 years. So now we understand what Laban's motivation was. Jacob was a hard worker. God was prospering him. And he wanted to get another 7 years out. So he came up with his plan of switching the girls so that he could get another 7 years of labor out of Jacob. Now you begin to say, okay, this is really strange. Now we would say, I mean, again, you read commentaries about this, it would not have been completely unusual for individuals to have more than one wife in this culture. And even if that is the case, it is still wrong. It is still sin. It still is going to produce all kinds of problems. And we'll see that as we start to study the life of Judah. So now we have the parents, Jacob and Leah. Goes on in verse 28. Jacob did so and fulfilled her week, kind of the honeymoon week, we might say. So he gave him his daughter Rachel as a wife also. And Laban gave his maid Bilhah to his daughter Rachel as a maid. So kind of help run her household. And Jacob also went into Rachel. He also loved Rachel more than Leah. And he served with Laban another 7 years. So, as you would guess, in a polygamous situation, one is always preferred over the other. And who knows what all the reasons might have been for that. But you can't have a second wife or a second husband without having favorites. So, Leah was the least favorite. Rachel was the favored one. Verse 31, when the Lord saw that Leah was unloved, literally King James says hated, so loved less by comparison is probably what that intends, he opened her womb, but Rachel was barren. So the older sister starts to have children. Leah conceived and bore a son. She called his name Reuben, for she said, "The Lord has surely looked on my affliction. Now therefore, my husband will love me." It's interesting to look at all the names of the children in this family, with the exception maybe of Dinah. But all the boys are named after the contentions between the sisters. The firstborn, see, a son. That's in essence almost literally how it might be, Reuben might be translated. See, a son. Now who's she saying see to? Well, her sister. All the children are named after the fight between the two sisters. So what we would begin to say, were we a psychologist today, analyzing, we would say, wow, what a dysfunctional family. It only gets worse from here. Verse 33, she conceived again. So a year, two later, we're not told. Maybe 3 or 4 years later, we're not told. She conceived again and bore a son and said, because the Lord has heard that I am unloved, he has therefore given me this son also. And she called his name Simeon. I mean, heard. God heard. God heard me. He didn't hear you. God heard me. So you see this sad situation. Now, can you imagine, as time rolls along, how would Rachel feel about Leah's sons, or sons and daughters, as the case would be? Would she have a close, warm, and loving relationship with those children? Is that possible? Or would they be seen as part of the conflict between the two sisters? He loves me, he doesn't love you. Yeah, I've borne children, you can't. Verse 34, she conceived again, a third time, and bore a son, and said, now this time my husband will become attached to me, because I've borne him 3 sons. So the indication is that Jacob lived, in essence, with Rachel, but would come and visit Leah in her tent. For, obviously, what we see going on here. So she names the third one Levi, which means attached. Now he'll be attached to me. So can you imagine being Rachel and calling attached, calling over all these names that are supposed to remind you that he really should love me and not you? Contention in the family. Verse 35, she bears again. She conceives again and bore a son. So now we're talking 2, 4, 6, 8, 10, 12 years over the period of time, possibly. She conceived again. Maybe there's 2 or 3 years between each of these boys. It could be a dozen or more years involved here. She conceived again and bore a son. Now I will praise the Eternal. Therefore, she called his name Judah. Then she stopped bearing. Judah means praise. So every time Rachel would deal with Judah, she, Leah, is praising God for all the sons that she has. And Rachel has none herself. So it would take quite a woman of character to love these 4 boys in the same way she might love her own children. Rachel apparently did not have that kind of character, at least at this time in her life. There's no indication that she thought well of these children at all. In fact, as time goes on, these children hate each other to the point that one, the others think he should be killed. He should be murdered. We don't have to put up with this kid any longer. So we'll see a dysfunctional family. Contention among the sisters leads to contention among the children. So Judah, praise, is born into this circumstance. Kind of leads us to the first lesson that I think we can draw out of Judah's life. And that is this. Few people have a perfect start. Few people have a perfect start. As I was discussing or commenting on Judah's background, some of you may have had pings in your nature. Yeah, I remember my parents couldn't get along. I was the least favorite of all the children, or wasn't the favored one. Most families have some story. If they have any number of children, it can be the case that she's the favorite, she's the golden girl, he's the favorite, he's the one who can do no wrong, we know what he's really like, he's not the lovey baby of the family, he is a little demon, and mom and dad just don't see it. Many families have those kinds of stories. Hopefully not ours in the church, but welcome to real life. Sometimes that happens. We may not intend it to happen, but it might. In chapter 30 here in verse 1, Now, when Rachel saw that she bore Jacob no children, Rachel envied her sister and said to Jacob, "Give me children or else I die," as if it's Jacob's fault. You can tell just the incredible frustration, sadness, again, spurred on, encouraged by this contention between sisters. Jacob's anger was aroused against Rachel. So again, dysfunctional family, yeah. Jacob, you can understand his anger. It wasn't appropriate, but you can understand it. In essence, he yells at her, "Am I in the place of God who has withheld you from the fruit of the womb? You know, you're the one that's the problem. God said you can't have children. What is it with you?" So again, hard to say exactly what Jacob may have said in this argument. I doubt that it was just one sentence. "Am I in the place of God who has withheld you?" You know, doubt that most arguments do not end with one sentence. So what we have here is the highlight sentence of the discussion. "So she said, 'Here is my maid, Bilhah. Go in to her, and she will bear a child on my knees, that I also may have children by her.'" So in this case, since she could not apparently have children, or at least was not up to this point able to, she decides to give Jacob her maid. So picture yourself as little Judah. Now you've got mom, and you've got, what is she, Aunt Rachel? What do you call this woman? I don't know. Not really my aunt, my second stepmother. I mean, it's just confusing from the start. And then you introduce another woman into the bedroom. You've got more confusion. So picture what this is doing to the boys. Is it possible that Leah's somewhat pride, "I've been able to have children, you're not," would that spill over into the children over the course of time in a superior kind of feeling? Who knows? So verse 4 or verse 5, "Bilhah conceived and bore Jacob a son. Then Rachel said, 'God has judged my case, and he has also heard my voice and given me a son.' Therefore, she called his name Dan," or judge. I've been judged. Finally, I've got this son. Well, it's not really my son, but it's kind of my son. It's just a strange situation. Talk about dysfunction. "And Rachel's maid Bilhah conceived again." So now we're talking about, what, 12, 15, 18, 20 years into the marriage, maybe by this time? Hard to say. We're not told whether Bilhah and the other four were contemporaneous or after. It seems to be after the case here. So a second son. "Then Rachel said, 'With great wrestlings I have wrestled with my sister, and indeed I have prevailed.' So she called his name Naphtali." So wrestlings. So again, each of these boys are named after the contentions between these sisters. So what'd you say? "Come here, wrestlings." Who are you wrestling with? You're wrestling with your sister for Jacob's love. So even though the scripture does not specifically say polygamy is an absolute sin, every time it's mentioned in the Bible, it brings horrible results and broken, destroyed families. Heartache and difficulty, whether it's Abraham, whether it's Jacob here, no matter when it's discussed, it brings trouble. Even the first couple chapters of Genesis, the same thing. So it's clear from God's law, this was sin, this was wrong. And yet we have this contention. So what would Rachel's, in essence, surrogate sons, what would they be like in dealing with their four older brothers? Hard to say, but could it be a completely harmonious situation under those circumstances? Now again, the sons would have been separated somewhat from their mother's contention, but not necessarily a lot. So verse 9, let's complicate the situation even more. Let's make the family even more difficult. Verse 9, "When Leah saw that she had stopped bearing," had four and was on a hold at this point, on pause, we didn't know that at the time, thought it was finished, "she took Zilpah, her maid, and gave her to Jacob as wife. And Leah's maid Zilpah bore Jacob a son. And Leah said, "A troop comes." So she called his name Gad, meaning troops. So every time she calls Gad, what's Rachel going to hear? Yeah, she's got a whole troop of kids, and I've got these two from my handmaid. Leah's maid Zilpah bore Jacob a second son, son number six from that side of the family, eight altogether now. Leah's maid Zilpah made, verse 13, Leah said, "I am happy, for the daughters will call me blessed." So she called his name Asher, which means happy. I'm happy with all these six boys. Now, what kind of family circumstance will this bring about? What kind of situation will Judah be raised in? Pretty miserable circumstance, to say the least. So if you have had a less than perfect start in life, do not despair. This is not the end of Judah's story. If you've been brought up in a situation something like this, or something maybe worse, something maybe not quite as bad or quite as strange, take courage. Most people do not have a perfect start in life. If you grew up in a dysfunctional family, you know, welcome to the club. Many others have as well. It has been said that every family is dysfunctional to varying degrees. Some very dysfunctional, and others somewhat dysfunctional. So these contentions between sisters spill over into the children. The favoritism that Jacob shows to Rachel obviously spurn Leah, and that spurning is going to have to be spilling out into the children without a doubt, because unless Leah is a woman of tremendous character, do you think she might say occasionally, "Oh, there goes Dan"? Would she say things like that? Yeah, that's because Rachel couldn't have children. So there's Dan. There's wrestler. The wrestling. Would you think that might be the case? Joseph had a favorite wife. Therefore, when Rachel finally has a child, he has a favorite son from his favorite wife. Goes on in verse 18. Maybe we'll go back to verse 17. God listened to Leah, and she conceived and bore Jacob a fifth son. Leah said, "God has given me my wages because I have given my maid to my husband." I have to endure my husband sleeping with my handmaid, so God has paid me for that. And again, we'll just be very frank. This is what the scriptures talk about. No reason for us to shy away from that, but to teach it the way it is. So she says, "I've gotten my payment for enduring that kind of humiliation." What a family this is. So she called his name Issachar. Issachar means wages. Can you imagine being called wages? What do you mean? What does my name mean, Mom? Well, son, I'll explain it to you when you get a little older, you know. It's this fight between sisters. What a terrible thing. So Leah conceived again, verse 19, and bore Jacob a sixth son. So now she has six of her own, two through her handmaid, so we got eight sons. And Leah said, "God has endowed me with a good endowment." And here's the point. "Now my husband will dwell with me because I have borne him six sons." Still this contention, this heartache that she felt because Jacob loved Rachel more. So she called his name Zebulun, which means dwelling. In other words, come live with me. Afterward, she bore a daughter and called her name Dinah, the only daughter recorded of the descendants of Jacob. There may have been others, but that's the only one recorded by name. Verse 22, God remembered Rachel, and God listened to her and opened her womb. Now, maybe over the course of time, there was a bit of an attitude change in Rachel, and God decided to answer her prayer. Maybe that wasn't all that was involved, but nonetheless, God heard. She conceived and bore a son. So again, at this point, we're what, 15, 18, 20, 25 years into the marriage, maybe 30 years by this point. So the age spread between the oldest and the youngest is going to be quite a number of years. Now, again, maybe they had them one year after another. What do they call Irish twins? Is that the comment where two kids are born close together and they look a lot alike and, yeah, they were 9 months apart or 10 months apart or 11 months apart, a year apart, very close. Maybe that was the case. So maybe Reuben was only 15 or thereabouts when Joseph was born. Verse 23, she conceived, bore a son, and said, God has taken away my reproach. So she called his name Joseph. Joseph is now added to the family. The Lord shall add to me another son. In other words, I mean, loosely translated, he will add, God will add, or addition. So you got wrestler, you got addition. It's strange names for these kids. We don't know. Joseph just is a very common name now. The Lord shall add to me another son. Of course, because this was favorite wife, Joseph now becomes favorite son. So Judah, growing up, would be somewhere in the lot of all these kids. Definitely not the favorite. That has an effect on a child. If they know that they're less than someone else in dad's eyes. Verse 25, it came to pass when Rachel had borne Joseph that Jacob said to Laban, send me away. So they decide to split their finances and go their own way. The family moves away from Grandpa Laban. Judah leaves grandfather and all that was involved with that, and they move out from there. Later on, they have to flee because two of Judah's older brothers just eventually murder a whole village of men over the situation that took place with their sister. Then they've got to come back, face Esau again, and possibly fight for their lives. So we would certainly say, what a dysfunctional family. And yet, the story is not over. So again, if you've grown up in a dysfunctional family, if you've felt unloved by those who should love you, rest easy. The story is not over. God can fill the gaps, and we'll show that along the way. We pick up the story of Judah in chapter 37. Genesis chapter 37. Genesis 37, beginning in verse 18, for our second lesson. The second lesson might be this: business must be moral. Business must be moral. We live in an age where many businesses simply are immoral. They're gathering immoral profits, sometimes from immoral products. And sometimes the people of God are pulled toward those things. Let's look at this example to see how we might draw this lesson out. Genesis 37, beginning in verse 18. Remember, Joseph comes on the scene. He's the favorite. God actually gives him dreams. And in those dreams, he is told that in essence, he's going to rule over all of his brothers. Now, if there wasn't enough contention in the family at the point before the dreams, now Joseph comes and says, hey, I've had this great dream. You know what? I want to be in charge of all you yahoos. Now, he didn't say it that way, I know. But that's the way they took it. Oh, yeah, punk kid? You imagine a 20-year-old young man and his 5-year-old little brother comes and says, I've had this dream. I'm going to rule over you. That probably is not going to go over real well. Especially when you already dislike him because of all the things your mother has planted in your head about how she's unloved and your father doesn't really love you like he loves them or him, etc., etc. Now we go on from there. Genesis 37 in verse 18. Now when they saw him afar off, who is being spoken of? When they, the brothers, 10 of them, saw him, Joseph, from afar. What was he doing? Well, dad was sending Joseph to check up on the brothers. Now, if you were a young man, would you find that irritating? Dad's going to send a little brother out here to check on us? Excuse me? If you look back in verse 13, Jacob or Israel said to Joseph, "Are not your brothers feeding the flock in Shechem? Come, I will send you to them." So he said to him, "Here I am." And he said to him, "Please go and see if it is well with your brothers and well with the flocks, and bring back word to me." Now, whether he just wanted a report or whether he wanted them to be checked up on, I guarantee you the way the sons took it was, snotty little brother is going to come and check up on us and bring a report back to dad. Has this happened before? Maybe it has. So he sent him out, and while they see him afar off in verse 18, even before he came near them, they conspired against him to kill him. So this was not a happy family in any sense of the word. They despised their brothers and sisters. If you've grown up in a family where you've had that kind of despising, it's painful to say the least. We're not just talking favoritism here. We're talking hatred. And in some families, and because sometimes of the way we as parents have dealt with children, they come to hate each other. And that's very tragic. It's very sad. Hopefully that doesn't happen in the church, but it can. We can make mistakes that way. They wanted to kill Joseph. And who was right in the middle of that? Well, it was Judah. Judah was all in on this murder of his brother, his half-brother, Joseph. Verse 19, then they said to one another, "Look, this dreamer is coming." The dreamer, the master of dreams, might be literally what they said. Oh, here comes the master of dreams. You can just hear the scorn in their voice. "Come, therefore, let us now kill him and cast him into some pit. And we'll say some wild beast has devoured him. We'll see what will become of his dreams." And just absolute despising, hatred toward their brother. And Judah's right in the middle of it. But Reuben heard it, and he delivered him out of their hands and said, "Let us not kill him." So it looks like at this point they have got their hands on Joseph. And Reuben has to come to the rescue and literally deliver him out of their hands. They're about to murder him. Reuben said to them, "Shed no blood, but cast him into this pit, which is in the wilderness, and do not lay a hand on him." What was his plan? That he might deliver him out of their hands and bring him back to his father. He was going to go back later, grab Joseph out of the pit, send him back home to daddy. Verse 23. So it came to pass, when Joseph had come to his brothers, they stripped Joseph of his tunic, the tunic of many colors that was on him. Then they took him and cast him into a pit, and the pit was empty. There was no water in it, and they sat down to eat a meal. Now, we talk about just despising. They had no conscience qualms about this at all. They grabbed him, threw him in the pit, took his coat, sat down to have lunch. No qualms. They hated him. Judah in the middle of it all. And they sat down to eat a meal. They lifted up their eyes and looked. There was a company of Ishmaelites coming from Gilead with their camels bearing spices, balm, and myrrh on their way to carry them down to Egypt. So, guess who? Judah. Judah said to his brothers, "What profit is there if we kill our brother and conceal his blood? Where does that get us? We can make some money here." So, verse 27, "Come, let us sell him to the Ishmaelites, and let not our hand be upon him, for he's our brother and our flesh." This small pang of conscience might have still been there, in spite of the hatred he felt toward his brother Joseph. And the brothers listened, so you know what happened. They sold Joseph for 20 shekels of silver. They made a nice profit on this kid. This was an immoral transaction. It was absolutely immoral. If you're asked in your job to do something illegal or maybe legal but immoral, we must refuse. We cannot be a part of immoral business transactions. And again, I'm not saying just illegal, because some things that are immoral are still legal, but they're just not right. Remember, we are to be ambassadors for Christ. And in our business dealings, in our jobs, we must be upright in each of those dealings. We cannot be party to immoral or illegal actions along the way. So business must be moral. Here, the brothers made a fine profit, but the business was immoral, and we would say illegal according to God's law. Let's go on from there. In chapter 38, we have lesson number 3 that we can draw from Judah's life, and that is to make your word your bond. Make your word your bond. Now, you probably already do this, but it's a good reminder for all of us. When we promise, we must carry it out. And again, we have another tragic instance from Judah's life that illustrates this importance. Chapter 38 and verse 1, it came to pass at that time that Judah departed from his brothers. So what we see over the course of time is that each of the brothers basically moves out, we might say, from the common family business and basically begins their own clan, their own family, from which, of course, we know the tribes of Israel would descend. So Judah makes the departure from the brothers. Judah saw there, in verse 2, mentions, first of all, he visited a certain Adullamite whose name was Hira. So probably a business transaction of some sort with Hiram or Hira. Verse 2, Judah saw there a daughter of a certain Canaanite whose name was Shua, and he married her and went in to her. So his family is now going to begin setting up his own family, separate from the brothers, we might say. So verse 3, she conceived and bore a son, and he called his name Ur. I don't think it should be pronounced error, but that's what it comes to be, sadly. Called his name Ur. Now, just as it's a pretty heavy sermon, so we probably should inject at least a little humor to, my guess is that Judah was asked, what do you want to name your son? And he went, Ur, and down they wrote it, and that was it from that day on. Maybe that was the case. Nonetheless, she conceives again in verse 4 and bore another son, and she called his name Onan. Onan and Ur. She conceived yet again and bore a third son. A son called his name Shelah. He was at Chezeb when she bore him. So we've got quite a number of years condensed into a very few verses here, because then in verse 6, Judah took a wife for Ur, his firstborn, and her name was Tamar. Now again, based on Judah's family life growing up, what do you suppose the chances of him having a harmonious, wonderful, delightful marital and family situation, what do you think the chances were that he'd have the tools to bring that about? Maybe not so much. That's not to say it couldn't be different. We've all known people who've had horrible family circumstances and then rise to say, I'm never going to do that in my family, and they make a complete change. Of course, with God's Spirit, that's always very possible. Nonetheless, Judah did not seemingly have parenting skills, and maybe his wife did not either, because there was something about these two oldest boys that was so despicable to God that he killed them. I'm not saying it's Judah's fault. Every tub sits on its own bottom. The boys certainly were at fault. But verse 6, Judah took a wife for Ur, his firstborn, and her name was Tamar. But Judah's firstborn, was wicked in the sight of the Eternal, and the Eternal killed him. Now, we're not told what he did, why he was killed, what wickedness was so bad about this individual that God just killed him. Now, God may have had plans, obviously, for the line of Judah, the descendants of Judah, and would have a certain standard involved, and this young man was nowhere near it. Maybe that's the reason. God was already planning millennia into the future, possibly. Nonetheless, was so evil. Again, dysfunctional family, I would say so. God killed him. And Judah then, verse 8, said to Onan, "Go in to your brother's wife and marry her and raise up an heir to your brother." This is prior to the book of Leviticus and the instruction that God gave to Israel on what we would call the levirate marriage. Levirate marriage was for a situation like this, where a son, older son, dies without anyone to inherit his property. Again, the firstborn, remember, got a double portion, so that when he received that, he could take the place of his father and care for the family. So he was given double, not just because he would have more for himself, but that he could care then for his family, for his other siblings, to make sure they were all going to be okay. So in this case, Onan was said, marry your older brother's widow, and then the first child that you have will be the one who will receive that blessing, that firstborn blessing, that double portion, and that'll be his descendant. And then the second son and the ones after would be then Onan's descendants and would receive his inheritance. Well, Onan didn't like that idea at all. So, verse 9, Onan knew that the heir would not be his. What did he want? Apparently he wanted that double blessing. Look, my brother's dead. I get it now. Well, no, you don't. He knew the heir would not be his, and it came to pass when he went into his brother's wife that he admitted on the ground, lest he should give her an heir to his brother. He didn't complete things. Obviously, she would not get pregnant. The thing which he did displeased the Eternal. That attitude of complete selfishness, as if material things are all that mattered. So many other things possibly about Onan that God despised, that God therefore killed him also. So here's Judah, his two oldest sons are put to death by God himself. With something so despicable about them, in addition to what we read here, that God killed them. So Judah made a promise, unfortunately one that he did not keep. And we'll see the tragedy that comes about as a result of refusing to follow your word, when you gave your word. So Judah said to Tamar, his daughter-in-law, "Remain a widow in your father's house till my son Shelah is grown." So apparently he wasn't quite of marriage age yet. "For he said, lest he die like his brothers." Now again, "for he said," did he say it to her? Probably not. He tells her publicly, "You stay a widow in your father's house, and when Shelah's old enough, I will give him to you, and he'll be your husband." When he turned around, he said, "That ain't going to happen. I gave her two of them. She killed them both. Think I'm going to give him another one? I don't think so." So he gave his word, but apparently never intended to carry it out. Tamar went and dwelt in her father's house. Now in the process of time, the daughter of Shua, Judah's wife, died. And Judah was comforted and went up to his sheep shearers at Timnah, he and his friend Hira the Adullamite. And it was told Tamar, saying, "Look, your father-in-law is going up to Timnah to shear his sheep." Well, what hadn't we been told? What we hadn't been told is enough time has gone by that Shelah was of age to marry. And Judah did not carry through on his promise. Now, whether he promised and then just reneged, or never intended from the start to follow through on that promise, both were sin, either one of them. So, they came up with a plan. Verse 14, She took off her widow's garments. In many cultures, once a woman is widowed, she wears certain clothing. Very quick example, our neighbor across the street from Eastern European heritage, elderly widow, probably 85, 86, 87, somewhere in that area. Her husband died about 6 years ago, and since that time, Pam and I have never seen her in any other clothing but a completely black outfit. And in discussing it with her daughter this past summer, a few of the other neighbors, she's starting to have some dementia issues, and she was wandering up the street. So we went up to bring Eva back, and other neighbors said, I just don't get this lady. I mean, she's always wearing black. I mean, it's 95 degrees out here. She's walking around in black outfit, long sleeves, long pants. What's going on? And so to explain to them, no, that's, she'll always wear that till the day she dies. It's their culture. They will wear black from head to toe until the day they die. They're mourning for their lost husband. It's their culture. They're not going to remarry. They're going to stay in that widow's outfit. So Judah saw something similar here. Tamar was wearing the widow's garment. Now, I should say we have seen our neighbor on a couple of occasions come out and get the paper or start raking her yard in her bathrobe. So as I say, some of the issues are starting there that we're concerned about. But nonetheless, Tamar puts off her widow's garment, covered herself with a veil, and wrapped herself. Again, obviously, we're clearly beginning to see some kind of provocative clothing here. And she sat in an open place, which was on the way to Timnah, for she saw that Shelah was grown, and she was not given him as a wife. So Judah either lied or simply went back on his word. When Judah saw her, he thought she was a harlot. Well, what do we learn? First of all, when we give our word, keep it. Because when you don't, all kinds of terrible things can happen. Leads us to this next point. Next lesson we can learn from Judah. Sexual sin brings calamity. Sexual sin brings calamity. Here, because of his lack of fulfilling his promise, she feels that she has perfect right to tempt him. And that's what he does. That's what she does. When Judah saw her, he thought she was a harlot in verse 15 because she had covered her face. She had the veil on. He turned to her by the way and said, please let me come in to you. For he did not know that she was his daughter-in-law. So she said, what will you give me that I may come in to you, or that you may come in to me? So again, think about this. A number of problems, obviously, about this whole scenario. He's lonely. He is a widower. So she takes advantage of that. She's been lied to, or she's been told one thing and he doesn't fulfill it. So she feels justified in this. And so we have all kinds of sin coming out as a result of this. Sexual sin brings calamity. So he said, verse 17, I'll send you a young goat from the flock. So she said, will you give me a pledge till you send it? Yeah, you say you're going to send a goat. Give me something to hold on till the goat gets here. And he said, what pledge shall I give you? So she said, your signet, in other words, your signet ring with your special seal on it, the cord and your staff that's in your hand. Then he gave them to her and went into her, and she conceived by him. So talk about a disaster. Verse 18, she arose and went away and laid aside her veil and put on the other garments of her widowhood. Judah sent the young goat by the hand of his friend the Adullamite to receive his pledge from the woman's hand, but he did not find her. So she left with the identifiers of Judah's presence. Then he asked the men of that place, saying, where is the harlot who was openly by the roadside? Where is this woman? I mean, she was right there. It was no secret to anybody. She was in full view. Where is she? And they said, there was no harlot in this place. We don't do that here. No one like that here. Verse 22. So he returned to Judah and said, I cannot find her. Also, the men of the place said there was no harlot there. Now Judah is embarrassed. He's been caught in his sin. And so he can't send people scouting around for this woman. He took his kind of his closest trusted friend to bring this goat and get his stuff back. He can't very well go around now trying to find out, where's this woman with my stuff? Well, why does she have your stuff? Well, verse 23, Judah said to her, let her take them for herself. In other words, drop it, leave it alone. Lest we be shamed. Oh, too late for that. For I sent this young goat, and you have not found her. Well, sad situation. The embarrassment, the calamity that comes from all of this leads us to our next lesson, lesson number 5. Apply standards equally. Apply our standards equally. In other words, if you're expecting something of someone else, make sure you expect it of yourself. Another way to say that is no double standards. Another way to say that is get the log out of our own eye before we try to get the speck out of someone else's eye. Genesis 38 and verse 24. It came to pass about 3 months after that, Judah was told, saying, Tamar, your daughter-in-law, has played the harlot. Furthermore, she is with child by harlotry. She's pregnant. So Judah said, bring her out and let her be burned. Well, for himself, it's, well, leave her. She can have the stuff. I don't want this out. I want this covered up. But when she's the one, well, clearly God later on says, look, both the adulterer and the adulteress should be put to death. There's no double standard in God's law. But Judah certainly had one. It's okay if I do it, but if she does, she needs to be burned, not just killed, but apparently burned alive. So not just killed, but vengefully burned. Now you wonder, again, trying to bring this into a real life situation, was Judah somewhat relieved that maybe now she would be put to death? So that he would not have to give his third son? He couldn't be accused of going back on his promise? Maybe that was part of it as well. Nonetheless, there's evil intentions in the midst of all this. The sexual sin brings calamity, and he tries to apply a double standard to her, not to himself. Verse 25, when she was brought out, she sent to her father-in-law, saying, by the man to whom these belong, I am with child. And you can almost imagine this. They're out probably in the square of the village, and the elders are there to make this judgment that this woman, because of her harlotry, should be put to death. And she says, well, here's the person who impregnated me, this person who owns these things. And so here's this staff that says, Judah, and the ring with Judah's seal on it. How embarrassing is that? Plays out when God told his people, you know, be sure your sin will find you out. The man to whom these belong, I am with child. And she said, please determine whose these are, the signet, the cord, the staff. So Judah acknowledged them and said, she has been more righteous than I, because I did not give her to Shelah, my son, and he never knew her again. What I believe happened at this point is a turnaround for Judah. It seems that this event caused him to look at things completely differently. It was one of those watershed events in life that allowed a person to see things in a way, a different way than they ever had before. And from the selfish, inward, we can make some money off my brother, I can sleep with who I want, etc., etc., we see a complete change beginning to take place. It came to pass in verse 27, at the time for giving birth, that behold, twins were in her womb. And so it was when she was giving birth that one put out his hand, and the midwife took a scarlet thread and bound it on his hand, saying, this one came out first. Why was that important? Because the firstborn would receive the double blessing and the double portion and care for the family. So the firstborn was important. But then it happened, as he drew back his hand, that his brother came out unexpectedly. So one started out, but then pulled the hand back in, and the brother jumps out, it seems. She said, how did you break through? This is the midwife speaking. This breach be upon you. Therefore, his name was called Perez, a breach or a breakthrough. I'm going to call this one breakthrough. He beat his brother out after all. So he technically was the firstborn. Afterward, his brother came out, who had the scarlet thread on his hand, and his name was called Zerah. Interesting, the scarlet hand has become a symbol through history to identify a portion of Judah's descendants. Don't have time to go into that now, but it's a fascinating story. What do we learn from Judah? Final lesson, we might say, is that God can recover us from our mistakes. God can recover us. We might use the word rescue. God can rescue us from our mistakes, but more often than not, it's recover. It's a process over the course of time. We will find that the lineage of Judah comes through primarily these two boys, the twins that were born from a terrible mistake. Some of us have a history of being a mistake. I don't say that insultingly, but many of you, or some of you, may have had that reputation in your family. Well, we weren't planning on having our kids, but then you came along. They were the mistake. I'm sure not the kind of mistake that we see here. But God honored these boys and used them, and I believe truly turned Judah's life around. This whole event finally bringing him to reckon with what he was and what he had done. Turn to chapter 43. The interceding chapters talk a little bit more about Joseph. You remember the story. We jump ahead. We see Joseph, having been taken captive into Egypt, rises on, obviously, by God's blessing, and becomes, in essence, Pharaoh over all Egypt, as far as a daily manager, second only to Pharaoh. And the brothers come because they're starving to death in Canaan. And they're brought before Joseph. These 11 brothers, or 10 brothers, came here from Judah, or the area of Canaan. And Joseph's ears perk up, of course, and he realizes this could be his family. So he's hidden, he talks to them, he gives them grain and sends them on their way. They get partway back, they open their bags to get some grain, and all their money's still in the bag. And now they're a bit afraid. They go home, they tell Dad the story, and he said, look, he asked all kinds of questions about you and all kinds of questions about our life here and all kinds of questions about Benjamin, our youngest brother. Something's up with this guy. He said, don't come back unless you bring the youngest brother. In chapter 43, we kind of pick up the story there. The famine was severe in the land in verse 1. And it came to pass when they'd eaten up the grain which they had brought from Egypt, that their father said to them, go back, buy us a little food, buy us more. Judah spoke to him. What do we see here? Not all that many years later, who is the spokesman for the brothers? It's not firstborn Reuben. It is Judah. Judah, we would say, seems to become a man of honor. In spite of all he had done, in spite of what he was, how he grew up, he becomes a man of honor. Judah spoke to Jacob, Dad, saying, The man solemnly warned us, saying, you shall not see my face unless your brother is with you. Now Joseph cast that, saying, you're probably spies. You're probably spinning a story. If you come back, bring your brother, then I'll know that you've been telling the truth. Otherwise, you're lying spies, and I'll have to deal with you. No, Joseph intended that simply to be able to see his full brother, his brother Benjamin. Verse 4, if you send our brother with us, we will go down and buy you food. But if you will not send him, we will not go down. For the man said to us, you shall not see my face unless your brother is with you. And Israel said, why did you deal so wrongfully with me as to tell the man whether you still had another brother? Who was the favorite son now? Still wasn't Judah, or Reuben, or Simeon, or Levi, or Gad, or Asher. It was Benjamin now, the son of his first wife, we might say, his real love, son of Rachel, who died in childbirth with Benjamin. He was now the favorite. Why'd you tell him you had another brother? Verse 7, they said, the man asked us pointedly about ourselves and our family, saying, is your father still alive? Have you another brother? Joseph must have wondered, did they kill him too, or try to kill him? Did they sell him into slavery? He wondered. We told him, according to these words, could we possibly have known that he would say, bring your brother down? Then Judah said to Israel, his father, send the lad with me. He's going to take complete and full responsibility. When he was the one who came up with the idea to sell Joseph, this must have been stunning when Joseph recognized what was going on. What a change. Judah said, send the lad with me, and we will arise and go, that we may live and not die, both we and you and also our little ones. I myself will be surety for him. I will give my life for his. I'll be the ransom for him. From my hand you shall require him. If I do not bring him back to you and set him before you, then let me bear the blame forever. Let me bear the blame forever. His father Israel said, all right, I guess we have no choice, and sent him on his way. Turn over a page to chapter 44. Chapter 44. Jacob sends the sons back with twice the money, the payment for the first grain, and now payment for the second set of grain that they were going to buy, and asks them to explain what happened. And we're bringing the money back to show that you're men of honor. Joseph, of course, sees his youngest brother, Benjamin, and is just touched by all of this. And so, what does he want to do? He's still operating, really, under information from decades ago that my brothers are who they are. They're not nice people. They don't like my brother because they didn't like me. I'm going to rescue him from them. I'm going to get my brother back. So you remember the story. They send them off with all their grain, and Joseph has his silver cup put in Benjamin's bag. And the soldiers go out after them. They stop them. They say, open your bags, and all the money's in there. And sure enough, the silver cup, Joseph's silver cup from the dining table, is in Benjamin's bag. So they haul them back in front of Joseph. Joseph says, what did you do? Chapter 44 and verse 18. You remember the story. All right, let's go back to verse 14. So Judah and his brothers come to Joseph's house. Judah. Now it's Judah and his brothers. He is the moral leader, we might say, of the brothers at this point. He and his brothers come to Joseph's house. And he was still there, Joseph. And they fell before him on the ground. And Joseph said to them, what deed is this you have done? Did you know that I am a man, that I can certainly practice divination? Couldn't you think I could do that? Then Judah said, what shall we say to my Lord. What shall we speak, or how shall we clear ourselves? How do we explain this? God has found out the iniquity of your servants. Here we are, my Lord's slaves, both we and also with whom the cup was found. Judah is, in the back of his mind, saying, we're finally getting paid back for what I did to Joseph. Getting paid back. We deserve this. Talk about a change of heart. He wasn't justifying. He didn't say, well, look, if we didn't have this brother that Dad treated so much better than the rest of us, gave him gifts, preferred him above everybody else. No. No justification at this point. But, verse 17, he said, be it far from me that I should do so. The man in whose hand the cup was found, he shall be my slave, Joseph says. And as for you, go up in peace to your father. Now I'll just take Benjamin. The rest of you can go. Then Judah came near to him and said, oh, my Lord, please let your servant speak a word in my Lord's hearing, and do not let your anger burn against your servant, for you are even like Pharaoh. My Lord asked his servants, have you a father or a brother? And we said to my Lord, we have a father, an old man, and a child of his old age who is young. His brother is dead, and he alone is left of his mother's children, and his father loves him. So Judah wasn't saying, you know, this snotty kid is Dad's favorite. He literally could see that Jacob and Benjamin's hearts were tied together. He didn't dismiss that. He didn't hate that. He just said, that's just the way it is. And you can understand a child that's born when your favorite wife there is on the birthing table, we might say, and she dies in childbirth. Wouldn't your heart be attached to this little baby? Of course it would. Judah recognized that. Then, verse 21, he said, then you said to your servants, bring him down to me that I may set my eyes on him. And we said to my Lord, the lad cannot leave his father. For if he should leave his father would die. They're tied together. But you said to your servants, unless your youngest brother comes down with you, you shall see my face no more. So it was when we went up to your servant, my father, that we told him the words of my Lord. And our father said, go back and buy us a little food. But he said, we cannot go down if our youngest brother is with us. Cannot go down if our youngest brother is not with us, then we'll go down. For we may not see the man's face unless our youngest brother is with us. Now again, it's our youngest brother. Judah does seem to indicate there's a real family feeling at this point. This is our brother. Then, verse 27, your servant, my father, said to us, you know that my wife bore me two sons, and the one went out from me. And I said, surely he is torn to pieces, and I have not seen him since. But if you take this one also from me, and calamity befalls him, you shall bring down my gray hair with sorrow to the grave. Now, therefore, when I come to your servant, my father, and the lad is not with us, since his life is bound up in the lad's life, it will happen when he sees that the lad is not with us that he will die. Please don't do this. So your servants will bring down the gray hair of your servant, our father, with sorrow to the grave. Can you imagine how this now is beginning to affect Joseph? Judah, the one who said, let's sell Joseph, let's make some money off this transaction, get rid of this kid, is now pleading with him for his father and his brother's life and making a good argument. Verse 32. For your servant became surety for the lad to my father, saying, if I do not bring him back to you, then I shall bear the blame before my father forever. They're not hiding things as they did before. And verse 33 shows the honor that had developed in Judah over the course of time. Verse 33, now therefore, please let your servant remain instead of the lad as a slave to my Lord, and let the lad go up with his brothers. For how shall I go up to my father if the lad is not with me, lest perhaps I see the evil that would come upon my father? I could not bear to see what would happen to my father if he's not reunited with his youngest son. So Judah offers to live a life of slavery to spare his youngest brother. Talk about honor. It is interesting that Judah, you might jot this down, Matthew chapter 1 and verse 3, figures very prominently into the lineage of Jesus Christ. You see, it's from the line of Judah that the Messiah would be born. You can change. You can overcome a disastrous background, disastrous decisions. With God's help, it can be done. Turn to Genesis finally, Genesis 49, a few pages over. At the end of Jacob's life, God inspires him to give blessings upon the 12 sons. And not only are these blessings, but they're prophecies. And as a result of Judah's turnaround, we can assume, a spectacular blessing is presented to Judah, and a spectacular prophecy, the one we mentioned in Matthew 1 and verse 3, that the Messiah would descend from Judah. Now, it begins in verse 8. We won't read the entirety of the blessing. We'll just look at it down through verse 12. We'll look at verse 10 because that's what we want to focus on. In spite of an immoral business decision, in spite of lying or going back on his word, in spite of applying double standards, and in spite of a horrible background and upbringing, Judah is the choice to bring out the Messiah. The physical descendant of Judah is Jesus Christ. Verse 10 says, "The scepter shall not depart from Judah." The kingly line of Judah would come from this family. "Nor a lawgiver from between his feet." In other words, the rulers. Judah became the spokesman for his brothers. He becomes, in many senses, the moral compass of the family. And it, as a result of those things, that God says he, his descendants, will be trained in such a way that they can be the leaders of the nation of Judah. First Israel and Judah, but then Judah itself. "Scepter shall not depart from Judah, nor a lawgiver from between his feet, until Shiloh comes." Shiloh is the Messiah. "And to him shall be the obedience of the people." So, brethren, it was Judah who turned his life around in such a way that he could be used by God to be the antecedent to the Savior. So as we close, it's important to remember that God is able to do great things through imperfect people who repent and turn to God. We are all a work in progress. Let's do our part to benefit from the lessons of the life of Judah.